Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Norwich. Welcome to the Playhouse. Please welcome a man who's been gorging himself on mustard all day while he's been here. It's Richard Herring. What a fuck up. Right, hello! Welcome, eventually. We'll leave all in. It's Comedy Gold. Welcome to Richard Herring's Little Spook on Tombland Alley podcast. And the people here know about her. The Augustine Stewart house was boarded up during the plague because everyone had died of the plague, but one little girl was still alive in there. The people of Norwich didn't care. They let her die and she's still banging on the door and let me out. So that's the 16th century that happened in, though it's Norwich, it could have been the 21st century. Though I was hanging around with a gang of graffiti artists in 2018 writing Les Dennis on all of the walls of Norwich, which is still the most exciting thing that has ever happened in Norwich. They call it Rahulastapas. I don't know if that's going to catch on. It's great to be back in Norwich. We've done some here before. Did anyone come see us? Yeah, it's a great time. Not many returners. It's great to be in Norwich. On the sign as you enter, or at least used to be, they think they've been nicked or something. It said, Norwich is a fine city. And I've been here and they're right, it's fine. It's fine. It's all right. And I'm so excited because we're very close to Great Yarmouth. So expect most of you have been down to see my bridge. Have you been to see the Herring Bridge? I have. Or maybe I'll pop down and see it. I'm here for a while. I'm here for 4 weeks doing this show. Maybe between this week and next week's show, I'll pop to Great Yarmouth. Have a look at my bridge. It doesn't look. They're trying to argue in Great Yarmouth Council that it was going to be called that anyway. But it wasn't. I made it called that, and it's named after me. And what else? What have you achieved in your life, mate? You got a bridge named after you know. That's going to be called the Herring Bridge for probably 50 or 60 more years before it falls into the sea. Let's crack on, I think. You know, we've had some fun. We've had some disasters. Let's see what can go wrong next. My guest this week is well known as being... There's a couple of things. He was the camera operator on Florence. pretty good. I've never seen someone with as many different sections of IMDb covered as this guy. He was also, of course, he was the floater in Doctor Who Redacted, and that's what I'm most interested in. Will you please welcome the incredible Alistair Beckett King, ladies and gentlemen? There he is. It's Alistair Beckett King. The floater.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
So what's happened there is, the premise of that joke is you choose usually a famous person and an obscure credit.
Yeah.
But what's happened here is kind of the inverse of that, because that's the most exciting thing I've ever done.
Well, I wanted to talk about it. I mean, it sounds like you played a piece of poo that wouldn't go down the toilet in the Doctor Who. Is that what it was?
I believe the writers of the piece might have had that in mind when naming the character,
yes,
who was an alien, a floaty alien,
right,
who was a poo. It was an alien poo, and I had six lines. Highlight of my career so far.
What was Doctor Who Redacted?
It was a podcast series. Okay. It was an LGBTQ plus podcast series,
okay,
and I'm not really LGBTQ plus, so they said you can be the poo if you still want to be in it. And I was like, yes, I do.
That's good.
It was very good.
What about being the camera operator? As I said, you've done a lot of different jobs on IMDb.
Yes, so that was when I was at film school. So basically, I have been unsuccessful across a range of media. If you think I'm mediocre as a comedian and children's author, you should see me doing everything else I've done. So I went to... Basically, my plan was to be Terry Gilliam off of Monty Python.
I know him, yeah.
And that's why I'm becoming increasingly right-wing. As I go, I identify as a black lesbian. The thing about being able to do a good impression of Terry Gilliam is nobody knows what he talks like.
It was good.
But it's pretty much exactly like that. But you don't know. If you're listening to this now, pause it and go and listen to Terry Gilliam and then laugh and email me about it. That's what he sounds like. I was a huge fan of Terry Gilliam, so I thought I'll become a filmmaker, and they were like, you can't do this. I made lots of short films. I made a very small number of short films that took ages and everybody hated. And then I started doing stand-up, which I was no better at, but it's just quicker and cheaper to be unsuccessful as a stand-up comedian. Like, a five-minute film takes months to make, but a five-minute set, it takes 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, I think you're being a little hard on yourself, Alistair, and also, of course, your skills that you've learned at film school have come very handy. I think we'll talk about that in a bit, but you do some amazing stuff online that I'm sure people have seen. Let's talk about... because this is an audio format, I think we need to paint a picture...
With
our words, yeah. Of you, I think I've told you this, but I was driving home from a Leicester Square Theatre podcast in London, and I was just driving past Tottenham Court Road, and I saw you from behind, like about 50 yards away, and I thought, that's Alistair Beckett King. And indeed it was.
Yeah.
So like, you are so individual that even in a city of 20 million people, a man can pick you out and go from behind.
From behind. That's the best way to see me.
Yeah.
This is why nobody comes to see me on tour, because you can just see me from most places. I'm tall, I've got long hair. If you're at a reasonable altitude, I'm visible.
Yeah.
Like the Great Wall of China.
You are a red-haired man, is what I will say.
I've got long red hair.
Yeah, but you've really doubled down on the red hair.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Some people would be ashamed and hide it, and I'm glad that you're not. I'm glad you're not one of those people. I'm just saying some people would just shave it all off. But you've gone the other way.
And deliberately so. Because when I was in school, it was the redheads would hide it, keep it under a bushel.
Yeah.
Whereas I made it into a bushel.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think it's time that we stopped hiding and came out of the shadows, but not for too long, because sunlight isn't great for us, and just reclaimed what was ours. Are there any redheads in?
Yeah.
It's not enough. Not really enough for the revolution I was hoping about. Forget about that. The revolution's cancelled, guys. We're not doing it.
But it is, I was reading Adam Bloom's excellent book, which we've talked about on a previous podcast. And, you know, he talks about the importance of, you know, having a image and knowing who you are on stage. But that's amazing that you've got such an image that you're instantly recognisable.
Yeah, it helps with the lack of material. Yeah.
The fact that it
really does. Like you were talking about seeing me from behind. I met somebody the other day I was working on something, and she said, "Oh, I've seen you before." And I was like, "Do you mean perhaps you saw me on the last series of Mock the Week?" And she was like, "No, I've just seen you before." And she had on her phone several photographs she'd taken of me over several years in a variety of locations. So I'm just like an extra who keeps cropping up in the background of her life.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a magical and terrifying moment.
Also, what I learned from seeing you from behind was if like Benny Hill style comedy ever comes back, you would be an
Fingers
excellent.
Crossed.
You would be an excellent guy who he thinks is a woman from behind who then turns around and has a beard. That you've got the lot. You've got the long hair. You're slim. So from behind, you know, you could be
relatively slim.
Feminine is what I'm saying from behind.
I am quite hippie. I hope the listener, that's coming across in audio. My
and
hips
then you turn around
quite
and then
shapely.
And then Benny Hill.
No,
could
it's
be on
happened.
Him.
Me and my girlfriend, not to show off, I have a girlfriend. have been walking down the street in York, where you're from, and someone drove past. A woman drove past, leaning out the window of a taxi, saying "Lesbians." And we're like, "Wait, no, bring that taxi back. That was inaccurate. An inaccurate hate crime."
Do you think, I mean, we come from the Northeast, and I've just been up in Newcastle, and so I know there are four, this is the place with the most redheaded people in England, certainly. But it's got 48 varieties of red hair there.
Is that like Heinz?
Yeah.
I didn't know. What kinds are... I'm aware, because I think I'm a redhead, but I'm aware that there is also ginger, which I think is maybe more orangey than
this. There's at least 48. I think, you know...
According to which authority?
I don't know. This was the fact for Newcastle. I made a joke about 50 shades of ginger. It was something like that. So, but... But yeah, so it's dying out, right? There won't be
recessive
redhead.
Gene. Yeah. And with climate change, you know, it's not looking good for us. Sorry, sorry to those three people, two now. Weirdly though, there was a lot of anti-redhead sentiment when I was at school, and I don't know if that's universal. I suspect it's because proper bigoted jokes weren't fashionable and were less fashionable maybe in the 90s. And so it was kind of acceptable and funny to make fun of redheads.
But yes, it was.
The lack of imagination is what really got me. Like when I was in school, there was one joke about redheads, which was, "Mate, your hair's on fire."
Yeah.
That's the reaction. I'm angry that you laughed. Because it's not funny at all. And I heard that joke 20 times a day for my entire school life. And one of the nice things about, I feel like a traitor to the North because I live in London. Nobody cares what you look like in London. It's quite nice to be able to walk around without people doing the same joke over and over and over again.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think in the...
I mean, obviously this is the wrong audience for me to say that that's a bad thing.
Yeah. In the 70s and 80s, when I grew up, there was a lot of ginger jokes still, but we could also do all the other ones as well. Yeah. But we still, even though there were so many to choose from, but... We still did. The ginger ones were still up there.
Fair enough. That was ahistorical of me to claim otherwise.
Good. Well, let's mention... You mentioned Mock the Week. Let's talk about Mock the Week because you killed Mock the Week.
Yes. Yeah.
You destroyed it.
I think the BBC felt it was too funny. It was a delight to be able to get a chance to. I remember watching that as a student,
right?
And thinking one day I'm going to ruin that show with my woke PC unfunny comedy. Bring back Frankie Boyle. That's my opinion. And they I was in the last episode, so I really,
yeah,
really,
you were really,
really
there.
That was a good show they had for a while.
You did it
not anymore.
You did a few. I don't think we can directly attribute it to you. I think they'd made the decision before.
Yeah, it wasn't just me.
It wasn't just you. It was just you and all the other new...
Sometimes they had women on, Richard. Sometimes there were women on it. You can't expect a good British comedy lover to watch a female comedian on a panel show without vomiting all over their screen. It had to be cancelled.
Yeah. How was it though? The last was it? Were the team emotional? Were the crew emotional?
It was a very weird recording for me because there was an awful lot of I remember the good old days, and I was like, I'm kind of new. It was like, have you ever been asked to sign a card for someone in a job where the person went on maternity leave before you were there? Because I've been in that situation. It's like, she doesn't know who I am. And they're like, you have to sign it. It's like, but she doesn't know me. And so the whole of the last episode, it's like, yeah, I wasn't really there for any of this. Thank you for having me.
Did Dara cry?
He was obviously a very angry man. Yeah. He was furious the whole time. No, I should say, it has a reputation for having been a bit of a bear pit or a gauntlet. But it had been on for so long that I think it changed into a different show. By the time The regulars and Dara O'Brien were extremely welcoming, frankly. You know, to the extent of sort of making sure you got to chip in and say your piece, which was nice, but... as an anecdote, unfunny.
Well, I thought it was a shame because I didn't. I found the early. I never disliked it, but I found the early series, like, you know, it was combative. It was everyone trying to interrupt each other, and I thought actually, out of all of those old long running panel shows that there are, it was the one that made the most effort to bring in new people in the series, and it was a window for stand up. So you know, if you're going to cancel one. News for you.
I don't know. I wasn't involved in the decision to cancel it. I don't know why I'm taking the blame for this. I mean, let's cancel. Have I got news for you?
It's never going to end. It's never going to end.
I've never been on it. Let's cancel it. Yeah.
But you know, it's a shame because it was. I mean, your generation of comedians must have felt that as well. It was a shame that it shut up just when it was like welcoming you in.
They do seem to have. I think they made an effort to start to give people a break. I mean, obviously, it's a show that gave lots of people their break. But I think there was a decision to try to showcase some of the newer, because there were lots of people like me who were, you know, all right. And had a chance to do anything on telly. And so it is a show. What are they going to replace it with? Repeats of Mock the Week. is what that, which is fine, because I get some money when they show one of the ones I was on. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Did you know this? You must know this.
I did not know
that you got repeat fees.
Well, it's kind of quite rare with panel shows. They often just buy you out with panel shows. So that you've done well.
I mean, it wasn't a lot. The finger thing that I rubbed... for the benefit of the listener, I rubbed my fingers together in the finger things mean the taxes kind of a way. It is not that much money.
Yeah. Can you rub coins together like that? Is that... Oh.
I'm just do it nearer to the mic.
Good. Let's talk about your books, because we'll make this a book club podcast, but again, it'll still be a proper one. Some people don't like the book club ones.
Do you have to download it? You know, they won't hear that if they haven't downloaded it. I'm so angry if they don't download it because they think it's a bad book club one.
Yeah. Well. What can you do? Let's talk about the books. Here they are. They're here. So there's two so far. Murder at the Museum. So they're kids' books, right?
They are for children.
They're for children.
Yes. So stupid adults. If you're not...
Oh, well, I enjoyed it, so I'm one of those stupid adults. Montgomery Bonbon, Murder at the Museum is the first one, and then Montgomery Bonbon, Death the Lighthouse. Now, you explain who Montgomery Bonbon is, because it's obviously... mysteries and detectives, but it's got a bit of a twist.
They are funny mystery detective books for... They're middle grade, which makes it sound like I'm saying they're fine. Like, not that good, but middle grade means that they're like 8 to 12. But anyone can read them, even Richard Herring.
They're easier to read than adult books, because... Yeah. They were nicely spaced out.
Way easier to write. So easy to write. Kids don't know anything.
I don't think that can be true, because it is still it's still a mystery, and it's still...
It's actually been horrible. The whole writing process has been nightmarish. So the premise is that when I was 10, I wanted to be a detective, and I told my dad I thought I would like to be a detective. I said, I want to be a detective or a stand-up comedian, and he sort of shook his head saying, I don't see that happening for you. But the reason he said I couldn't be a detective is that nobody would ask a child to investigate a serious crime, which, to be fair to the man, is is correct, but he's a realistic man and he just stamped on my dreams. And so I spent decades seeking revenge. And so the premise of the books is that Bonnie Montgomery is a 10-year-old girl with a gift for solving mysteries. But to solve the crime, she puts on a fake moustache and a beret and a sort of David Suchet playing Poirot kind of a voice. And she solves them in the character of Montgomery Bonbon. And none of the adults can tell that she's actually a 10-year-old girl wearing a false moustache. But apart from that, they are proper mysteries with proper clues. And there's no aliens or ghosts, so they're proper fair play mysteries. But writing them is... You've written loads of books. It takes so much more nerve than stand-up. Like, I didn't realise how needy we were as comedians. Because when you're writing a stand-up show, every other sentence, you turn to the audience like, huh? Did you like that? Because if you didn't like it, I'll take it out. And people give you feedback all the way.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Whereas with a book, you have to do the... With a kid's book, you have to do the whole book before any child reads it.
Yes.
And it's too late then. It's been printed before you find out if any children like it.
Yeah. I mean, so it's what made you want to do this? I mean, obviously you've said that it was your ambition to be a detective. What sort of drew you towards writing for kids, and how did you make this happen? Because it's very difficult to get books published.
And, it is, but not for me.
Okay. Tell us about how it happened.
It was a bit jammy, and I feel bad saying it, because there are so many aspiring authors and authors who've worked and grafted so hard. But what I did was do some funny videos on Twitter during a global pandemic. Basically, I had a very good pandemic. It was great for me. Things were going nowhere, and by the end of the pandemic, I was riding high on a wave of amusing, moderately amusing, quite well-lit Twitter videos. And one of the things I did was an interactive whodunit on Twitter.
Oh, yes.
Over the course of about a week. And you could play along. You still watch it on YouTube, but you can't vote in it anymore, but you can still play along and try and work out who did it. Gronje, my editor at Walker Books, saw that and got in touch and said, "Do you have an idea for a children's book?" And I said, "Yes." And my lifelong dream of becoming a children's author began and immediately came to fruition. No, I did work hard at it. I had to write. I wrote lots of stuff, and it took ages to turn into an actual thing. I did struggle, but just not that much. Not enough to turn it into a... I had the middle class white guy version of a struggle. And now I'm a published author.
Yeah.
Whey! Finally!
Well, I think, that's fact. You
finally!
The videos you do are incredible. Again, maybe we can talk about them now, we can talk about it later, but the production values are awesome. They are very funny. You're a very good actor.
I don't know why you had to italicise "are."
Because you were sort of saying...
They are very funny.
You're sort of going, they're medium, they're all, you're all putting yourself down, but they're very funny, and they're incredibly impressed, because there's a lot of people putting videos online.
Are there bad videos on the internet?
There are ones which I would say the production values are not as high as yours.
The annoying thing about... I get so many compliments for the lighting in my videos. But, like, people say, like, "Oh, the BBC must be knocking you... battering down your door." It's like, they have people who know how to do lighting who work there already. Like, being the comedian who's best at green screen is a useless skill outside of a pandemic where you're not allowed to leave the house. It was so useful during that time, but outside of that, it is quite useful. I would love to get more compliments on the writing and jokes and accents.
I think they're very, very funny, but it's good that works. That, because I think it is so difficult for comedians and people who want to write and be funny to get discovered, and so that is an absolutely valid way to get discovered, to create something and put it online. It's I think it's what I've sort of been saying for a few years about. Rather than doing Edinburgh, if you've got the money to do Edinburgh, you've got the money to make a well-produced series of videos that you can put online that people will actually definitely see.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. When I was starting stand-up, which was in about 2012, everyone would say, the received wisdom was, don't put your stuff online.
Yeah.
But, of course, in those days, everybody's cameras looked terrible and the sound quality was always awful, and so you wouldn't be representing yourself well. But it's the opposite of everybody's advice now, which is you've got to film yourself doing banter with someone from the first row and put that on Instagram every single day, even though apparently it makes everyone very sad to do that. I don't do reels. I don't film me doing stand-up and put that online. I like doing the... I think the thing about the... I like to spoof. I'm quite good at spoofing things. Yeah. And I think I understand how films are put together. And so with a lot of people's approach to comedy is like, you know, actually, we're not going to put much effort into this because, like, it'll be so bad it's good. But I think if you... I think it's funnier to put too much effort into something that's stupid. Isn't it funnier to try really, really, really hard? I feel like whenever someone brings out like a really good prop or in a stand-up show, I'm so excited that they've spent time making it look good rather than go, oh, I'll just do something crap because it'll be funny to not try. It's like, this isn't rock and roll. Comedy is for try-hard nerds. It's not for cool people. And so, like, trying to do a spoof and trying to make it look like the thing I'm actually spoofing, trying to get the shot size roughly the same. I don't know. That I think about the arguments that Python had on the, you know, when they were making the Holy Grail, and the Terrys would be trying to get all smoke and atmosphere in there, and Graham Chapman and John Cleese would be moaning about that because they just wanted to say jokes.
Yeah.
And the Terrys are right. It's funnier. Like, the films are funnier because they look like... Yes. You know, they do a good job of recreating medieval England or the Holy Land. You know, it is better if you do it seriously and properly and then say loads of stupid stuff. Right? Yeah, so screw you, John Cleese. What do you know?
I think I heard you talking to Stuart Goldsmith. I was listening to you talking to Stuart Goldsmith about the interdimensional ABK, which was a show you did in Edinburgh, which had a 2-minute video at the beginning of it.
I toured it last year because that video took so long to make.
Right.
I had to really make it financially viable. Yeah. I had to bring the show back and tour it. And so I did a Japanese style animation, like a Thundercats animated intro.
It's astonishing. It's online.
It is really good. If you haven't seen it, it's worth watching.
But you were saying, you know, the part of the joke is the length of time it must have taken you to put it together.
It did take months, but yeah. I do think committing to... You can't ask people, would you like that? You can't do the needy comedian thing of, would it be funny if I had, like, a lavishly animated introduction to this that would take me months to do? You have to just do it and completely commit to it and then show it to people and hope that it's good. And weirdly, it ruined the show for a bit when I was working on it because the show was going quite well and then I started... doing previews with the video, and the video was so polished that I couldn't just come out with notes and be like, so my name's Alistair, and so it meant I had to improve the show to live up to the build-up that the video is giving it.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
So look, all this led to writing the book and doing the book, and I think it's interesting that obviously, like, there's a lot of big name comedians are sort of made to or advised to write books, or have got all that.
Made to write books.
I think they are probably made to do it. But, you know, it's become really big business. But there are a lot of... We had Beck Hill on recently, and my own wife, Katie Wilkins. She won't use the name Heron
for
some reason.
Most people would say my wife rather than my own wife.
My own wife.
it just seems to emphasise ownership, and frankly, I'm uncomfortable with that, and I just want to distance myself from that verbiage.
Beck Hill isn't my... She's not my own wife. She's everyone's.
She's everyone's wife.
That's what I was doing.
I don't know if I think we hold Beck Hill in common.
My wife. by my, I am her husband. Let's say that. Examples of they've found funny, they, you know, they've found funny people and said, you know, write actually funny book and a comedy book, and it's sort of, it's good that that's happening because it's so easy to for them to say, you know, well, let's, who's on TV, let's get them to, you know, maybe write this book, or maybe let's give them a book they can say they wrote.
Yes, and so well, of course, we would never imply that any comedian doesn't write their own books.
No, that would be terrible.
We would never say that.
And imagine having the time to do all the stuff on TV and write all those books as well. They must.
Whoever we're thinking of must be tired. So I did this. I started writing the book before I was on the television show Mock the Week that I destroyed. So I hadn't done any telly. So there was no chance of me being mistaken for a celebrity author, because you have to be a celebrity to be a celebrity author. But it is also a different thing. Like, the celebrities' books come out at Christmas,
yeah,
because the, you know, because they're famous. Whereas I suppose real children's authors' books don't come out at that. And so I wanted to. You know, I want to try and be a real children's author. You know, I want to try and do it. Fortunately, I wasn't a celebrity, so I didn't have a choice about that. But I do feel a bit jammy because, unlike most debut children's authors, I do have thousands of social media followers. So yeah. It was... That said, that's not... These days, Twitter, nobody reads Twitter. And I have got a moderate-sized YouTube... I think I have 250,000 YouTube subscribers.
Right.
Did the mics pick that up? But the thing is, like, they're all like middle-aged Albanian men. So I can post to say I've got a book. I can post to say I'm going on tour. I posted to say I was going on tour, and someone replied saying, "Doing what?" Like, what do you think this is? What do you think has been happening between us? Why do you subscribe? Sorry.
But, you know...
That's what I said in reply.
But I think we're especially writing kids' books. Obviously, there are serious kids' books and there are adventure kids' books. But, like, you know, I'm sure, like me, I loved funny books as a kid. And I think most kids love funny books. And I think, you know, a comedian will... Most comedians will get what that level of funniness is, which I think... Because it's a different thing than knowing what will make an adult laugh, what will make a kid laugh. It's a difficult thing that I think most people would struggle. Maybe a lot of comedians would struggle with that.
It's weird. And what's funny is, we were just saying this before, but I think the kids often laugh at a funny idea more than they do a funny line. Like, I think having sort of presented, you know, sort of pitched the book at kids, essentially, I sometimes going into schools with permission, and they ask you to do it. I don't just arrive with a big sack of books. Talk about what it means to solve a mystery, how do we let's invent a detective together, that sort of thing. I think kids love to sit in a funny idea and be like, oh wow, yeah, that's a funny idea. Rather than, I think a one liner can be sort of too abrupt, too sharp for a child.
Yeah,
like if I do a gig for, I was about to say humans, I mean adults. If I was talking to humans, I do a joke where I mention the fact that I don't have eyebrows, and the audience notices that I don't have eyebrows, and then they laugh at the joke. It hasn't happened here. But that's fine. Too little, too late. Sorry. And for the benefit of the listener, I do have eyebrows, but they're basically invisible. But the rest of my face is super hairy, so it's fine. But if I do that same joke for kids, they don't laugh. But then what I do at the end, I'll say, any questions, and you can ask me any questions. You can ask me about doing animation or books or why I don't have eyebrows, and I just include it in the list. And when they realise that they can make the joke theirs, you know, after a few serious questions, someone will be like, where are your eyebrows? And I'll say, I lost them on the way to the school. And then someone else will, and then they'll just keep asking me about that. And if they find it, the more annoyed I pretend to get... They find it hilarious to keep asking about the eyebrows, and they don't know that I set that whole thing up. I engineered that entire thing to give that to them. They have no idea.
I underlined one of my favourite jokes. A couple of them, I found one of them. He wore shoes that clacked as he crossed the parquet floor, and one of those small triangular beards that make people worry the wearer is about to do a card trick.
I love that. I'm a huge fan of magic and conjuring, but the books contain a number of anti-magic jokes, and I don't know where it's come from.
It's a good joke though, and this is the other one. Which, again, I like this because you sort of have to. We don't have to go back, but it's octagonal walls were topped with nasty little spikes designed to make pigeons or anyone else think twice before having a poo.
I think I'm laughing at that. I wrote this 3 years ago. Can't remember any of this. It's like, that's pretty good.
But that's, you know, my son at the moment, my son's just going through a period where, I don't know where he got this from, where he just thinks saying the word Willy is hilarious. Just endlessly saying the word Willy. I mean, I did go through a phase from about the age of 4 to now of thinking that too. But it's, you know, but so anything with poo is going to work. But that's it's a lovely joke, and it's sort of a joke that you have to flip your head, you know, you have to flip back to the poo bit.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a little bit of poo in it, yeah. But it's not a poo heavy novel.
Well, no, it's because it's, you know, it's a genuine mystery, and you're very engaged with it. And what I find interesting, it's obviously like if you're aiming at 8 to 12 year olds, and it is about a murder, it's not a grisly murder.
Oh yeah, there's a real murder in it.
There's a murder.
That was my first question when I spoke to the publisher. Can you have murders in books? And she said yes, and I said right, I'll do it.
But I think, again, I remember as a kid the stories I was writing, the Thryling Three, if people may remember from Collings and Herring, if they go back far enough, and as it occurs to me. You know, that was about a group of, you know, kids, of one of whom was based on me, solving murders, you know. And, like, you don't know what, you know, you don't really appreciate what a murder is. You just know it's an exciting thing to happen in a mystery. And this, but this book has a proper... I like that. It's got a proper story, and you've got suspects, and you've, and there are clues. So it's.
I mean, you are basically just describing what a mystery story is.
But it's got pages.
It works. Illustrations. It works. A typeface.
It works as a story.
It's got everything.
And I learned something. Oh, I learned something reading your book about clues. Where the word clue comes from.
Oh, yeah, it's got facts in it as well.
Yeah.
The word clue, do you want
to
say it?
Yeah, I would like you to tell people, it's going to blow their mind.
Well, I'm sure some people here know this is Norwich, but in Old English, so the word clue, meaning a fact in a mystery, comes from clue, C-L-E-W, meaning thread. So a clue is a thing you pull on, like you pull on a thread. So if you read anything from the olden days and you see a C-L-E-W, they're not talking about a mystery clue. They're talking about a piece of string.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more interesting in the book.
I think it's amazing.
Than it is to explain to a room full of adults.
I didn't know that, but I think that's, you know, it's a great way the book's making you laugh and you're learning something. And also you're pulled along in the story trying to work out who the murderer may be.
I'm glad you're... my dad didn't finish it.
Did he die before he got to the end?
No.
Is this a way of saying he died?
Sadly, he's still alive.
Sadly.
My dad said, it's I got 150 pages in. It's not aimed at me, really, is it? I think it's for posh kids. That's what he said. I think it's for kids who go to private schools.
Oh. Put it on the cover.
But they do have more money, actually, the private school kids. So, yeah, if you are a private school child, please buy my book.
I think any kid who likes comedy and...
It's for the clever kids.
I think it is clever, but I think reading is increasingly for clever kids without this government, am I right?
Wait.
I turned it round.
I'm not clear if...
I was just saying kids.
Were we enthusiastic about illiteracy there, or were we... Yay! Yeah, okay. The row two are really enthusiastic.
And so the second book, which I haven't read, but I have bought, and that's the important thing, right?
That is way more important to me.
Death at the Lighthouse.
So they don't have VAT on them, kids' books. So you're basically making money. Please buy them.
So they're more planned. It's going to be a series.
There will be. I agreed to it when I didn't realise how hard it was to write. So there's going to be two more, right. And I'm redrafting book three, which is probably called something like Mystery at the Manor, because I want to move the characters through the sort of the stock locations that mystery stories have. Because it's, I think it's quite fun to try and do something which is simultaneously a parody of the genre. So doing a big old country house and maybe the fourth one might be on a boat or something like that. But also an example of the thing itself. To try and do a proper mystery but also spoof it at the same time. And also, I guess, because some kids might not have read a mystery story, just explain the conventions of the genre to them so that they, you know, explain how clues work and what denouements are.
Yes. Yeah, it's really great. I really enjoyed reading the one I read, so congratulations. Do buy the books. Very good Christmas gift. This podcast might go out after Christmas.
A fantastic Easter gift.
Lovely Valentine's gift for a child. If you want to.
If you've got a special child in your life. I'm not sure I'm happy with my books facilitating this sort of thing, but a sale is a sale, so.
Right, let me ask you, let's get out of this awkwardness by asking you some emergency questions. I'm going to ask you a would you rather question from Richard Herring's Would You Rather book, available in the foyer after the show. Here you go.
This a fine is the, gift for a paedophile.
This is the one. I only perform two paedophiles. The whole audience. So you picked the wrong people to take the piss out of today.
I didn't realise there were so many illiterate paedophiles in. I apologise.
Right. Would you rather be a diplomat, own a laundromat, or have a very nice bath mat?
Oh, I'd love to have diplomatic immunity.
Oh, yeah, well, that's
that would be good, wouldn't it? There's no laundromat immunity. There's no bath mat immunity. Bathroom mats probably get quite a lot of wee on them, so... Yeah. I think as a kid, I only listened to one episode of The Goon Show, and the plot was someone had been killed by a falling piano, and in order to get away with it, they needed to go and screw diplomatic plates, like a license plate, onto the piano. Which, as you can imagine as a child, I found hilarious. I thought that was the idea that you could give a piano diplomatic immunity.
Yeah.
I mean, I've not done it justice.
Just do some funny voices. So,
There's
the goons. He did one a week, but it's just people going... And then they got a bloody band in, players, music. Cheats. Good stuff. It was good stuff. Well done, Spike Milligan. He's one of my heroes.
I don't feel like Spike Milligan, who wrote every episode himself and went completely mad doing that, was working hard enough on those. Let's really kick him.
Right, one more from here, because this is a philosophical... There's everything in this book. Would you rather know how you'll die or what will happen to you after you die? Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it's a good question, but perhaps not as good as the audience reacted. I think of myself as a non-practicing atheist, because I was a very annoying Richard Dawkinsy atheist.
Were you?
Because there's no proof, is there, Richard? There isn't, though. And it's the thing about that. And then I realised, and I'm still an atheist, but I realised that it's not that a good portion of atheists are more interested in being wankers than they were in being atheists. Like, you know, facts don't care about your feelings, but like the feeling of being right on the internet is also a feeling, you know? And so my answer is that nothing happens after you die.
Yeah,
so I already know. So I choose the other one, which is knowing how I'll die.
I think that's
and
a good
then
answer.
I would avoid it. Because I've heard folk stories and it's definitely possible to do that. Whatever it is, I would be too wily.
Yeah, they do. It usually rebounds on people, doesn't it, when they know how they're going to die.
And not me.
They can avoid it.
If I'm going to drown, I'll just go for a sleep in a dry bower. It's very unlikely that a spring will suddenly come up from the earth, drowning me in my sleep. It couldn't happen. What? One person knows the folk story. York-based, I think the Os Motherly near York is where that, one of the places that story
I'd prefer that just as a thing you'd imagined. That's the first thing that sprung to mind. It's weird that you die, isn't it? I kind of just, I was checking in.
With me that I die or that anyone?
I was checking into...
This is very broad observation of comedy.
What's that all about?
I was checking into my hotel and they had... I was on camera and the camera was, you know, sometimes it's just slightly out of sync. So you look away and then you look and then you see yourself look away. And for some reason then I thought, one day I'm just not going to be there at all. I think I suddenly disconnected from the because the person wasn't me.
Not at the Premier Inn.
Yeah.
I had the same experience at that. I was here on tour earlier because there's something wrong with that TV. The image is burnt in, which means that you're semi-transparent, I think.
Right,
If I remember correctly, like you can slightly see through yourself.
Maybe that's what
when you look at it. So it is like looking at a ghost of yourself. I also have had...
And it's a ghost of yourself that's not doing what you're doing.
Yeah,
so it's
a moment of mortality in the,
died,
in the Norwich Premier Inn. It is
one day
because I heard, I don't know where, that the brain can live for 500 years, but the other organs conk out sooner.
Okay.
And it's just like 500 years, that'd do me.
Yeah,
I think. I'd love to live for 500 years.
As just a brain, though, or would you like the rest? Would you like to keep on
not
moving?
Not bothered about the rest of it.
No?
I've got a very distanced relationship with my body, I think. I think people see me mostly as a brain.
Yeah.
And I'd be very happy.
I think you'd need to put a wig, a red
so
wig.
So people could recognise. If you saw a red wig on a brain, you'd be like, oh, it's ABK.
It would. It'd be fine.
That's it. Wrap a little corduroy around the bottom for the trousers. Can you wear flares on a jar? I don't know.
They can do anything in the future. I mean, the next generation, although I think the problem with this is that the world is going to be destroyed, but the next generation is meant to be the immortal generation, so my kids might sort of live for... I mean, you won't be immortal because there'll still be accidents and eventually the Earth will, you know, fall into the sun. And eventually the universe will fly so far apart that everything's dead.
Yeah.
So you won't be immortal, but you could live for 500 years, maybe.
500 years, yeah.
I think there comes a point, you know, the idea of living on after you're dead is just too... Living for eternity is worse than...
Oh, it's too much.
It's worse than dying.
500 years, you know, I'm watching, you know, loved ones and friends pass away. I could deal with that.
Okay, so it's only you living for 500 years.
Oh, yeah, no, that's fine. I'd be happy for others to come along. But, I could handle that.
Yeah.
Looking on the events of the day, like the Count de Saint-Germain. Am I saying that correctly? Am I saying that correctly, one person who knows about folklore? Count de Saint-Germain? I'm not saying it right.
How would you say it?
No way.
Comte
Saint-Germain?
Are
you French? No way. No way is that the correct...
We'll ask next
week. The Count of Saint-Germain.
We'll ask next week's guest. If you can hang around till next week, we'll ask next week's guest about that and she'll be able to tell us.
Good, good.
She'll be able to tell us in Spanish and French.
Phew.
But there we go. The emergency questions are working well. We're going to stick with the emergency questions. I'm not going to ask you if you've ever seen a ghost because I don't think you've seen a ghost. So tell me if I'm wrong.
I have... not seen a ghost, but I have... No, I have had the experience of seeing a ghost. I was reminded of this because I went back to the hotel it happened in recently.
Was it the Premier Inn in Norwich? Was it yourself on the screen?
Weirdly, it was you. It's a real delay on it. Years ago, I did a gig in Middlesbrough. So I'm from the northeast of England. So it was the first time my parents and sister, I think, came to see me do stand-up. And I was doing a middle 20, which is quite a low-pressure spot. It's the easy one. And it was a bad gig. I got laughs for the first 5 minutes, and I got laughs for the last 5 minutes, but the middle 10 was just death, just pure silence. There's an example of that. It was like this, horrible. And... There was a table of teachers at the back who were chatting all the way through, and it was the first time my parents had seen me doing it. It was in a hotel, which is a horrible place for a comedy venue.
It was in Middlesbrough, which is a horrible place to do comedy.
Which is a terrible place.
It's a horrible place to live.
Place.
It's where my family are from, so I'm allowed.
And partway through, and these places, they've got bad lighting setups. Partway through, there was like a spotlight on a small area of the audience for no reason. And thank you. And I caught sight of it, and I thought I saw my girlfriend's parents, who were also from the Northeast. So I thought, oh, they might have come along.
Yeah.
You know? And I was dying. So you know the way, I don't know if you're aware of this, the audience might not be. Like when you're doing stand-up, if it's not going well, you sometimes sort of have multiple brains running. You're talking, but you're also thinking through how bad it is.
Yep.
And then you're planning, well, I can't do, if the good bits aren't working, I can't do the bad bits. so you're editing as well. And so one level of thought was going, oh, that's annoying that they came out to see me having this horrible gig. And then I remembered that my girlfriend's dad had died.
You're a very caring and attentive partner. Oh, yeah.
Remember, I was running three levels of brain, though, so don't judge me too harshly. But I had, obviously, it was simply, it's the Northeast, the gene pool is not wide. I don't need to tell you guys. It was just two people who looked like my girlfriend's parents in the audience, but I had the weird rug pull, stomach twisting while also dying on stage. Yeah. I had that weird, like, levitating sense of
the idea that you were being led towards the light.
Like a literal death on stage.
But it was
a genuinely horrible, chilling experience.
What I'm interested in, though, is that your girlfriend's mother wasn't dead. So what you were imagining was that she had come to the gig with the ghost of her husband.
Yeah.
And was happily sitting there with him.
If you've already bought the tickets, you might as well. Okay.
Good. I didn't expect that.
So the answer is no. No, I haven't, seen a ghost. But I have thought I saw a ghost.
Okay. All right. We're going to ask this question. You're lucky to get this question.
Thank you.
But we're doing it because we're out in the sticks and...
These people don't know any better.
The people it will just make them happy. Their lives are not good. And this would just, you'll see what joy it brings. Just, you'll see what joy it brings them. Then we'll move on. Would you rather have a hand made out of ham? Look at that. Pathetic, isn't it? Or an armpit that dispenses sun cream.
I'm so glad you asked.
Because, yeah, I mean, I've got a clue on this one. I think I know
what
you're
going to
go.
Well, the thing is, I'm a very pale vegan.
Yeah, that's what I'm...
So there has never been an easier emergency question to answer for me than
Let
ham.
Me just say, as I always do, the ham isn't made out of pigs. It just is ham, though no pig has died. It's just grown on your hand. No, no animal has died to
But
create.
Once I get a taste for it.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I think once you get a taste for hand ham, real ham will never be enough. You want it to be the hand.
But the thing is, I would want an armpit that dispenses sun cream, even if it weren't an either-or proposition.
Yeah.
That would be so convenient. So often been caught without sun cream. Yeah. Is it high factor?
You choose the factor, but you have to stick with it. You can't start messing around changing the factor.
Well, I'm not going to want anything less than 50, so...
Okay, you can have 50.
Let's make this happen. Yes,
okay,
please.
We'll sort that out for you. That's terrific. Just one more thing about the book that I wanted to talk about, because there's some lovely illustrations in there. How did you choose your illustrator?
The illustrator is Claire Powell, who is an extremely funny and very talented illustrator, and illustrates Simon Farnaby's books as well, which is why my character wasn't allowed to have red hair, because his protagonist has red hair, as well as lots of other brilliant books. So I was really lucky. She was the person I wanted to illustrate it, and I was really lucky that we got her. And the annoying thing about it is that she's put several jokes into the illustrations that I didn't write. And people are all like, this one's so funny. I'm like, is it? Ha! Funny drawing. I had to invent the whole thing. No, she's really, really great. And also, it's I'm quite an... I don't know if this has come across, but I'm quite an emotionally repressed... English northern man. I'm half Scottish, and so sometimes there's a point in the second book where the protagonist doesn't hug her friend after a very tense situation for a plot reason, and in the drawing Claire drew them hugging,
right?
And as soon as I saw it, I was like, yeah, they should have hugged. That's the right emotional beat. But what's good about that is having someone with, like, emotional intelligence and a heart just coming on board to sort of fix my mistakes, so that you still get the vibe that they had that moment, even though I expressly did not write it. Because I'm more about the gags and the mystery, not really bothered about the characters' internal lives or emotions. uninterested in that, as you'll see if you read the books. No, they are quite good. I do make an effort, honestly.
They are, but it's very
I feel
good.
Like I've been doing them down. Please,
you
please,
do, but that's
please
what you do.
Buy them. And come and see me on tour. I'm here in May.
I was going to go on to the tour.
Oh, sorry, I just remembered.
You've ruined everything. You've ruined the whole thing by bringing
start
it up.
Again. Start again.
We'll start.
I'll spool back. Sun cream, please.
Okay.
Perfect edit point there.
I wanted to know also about the books, whether there's... It feels like it would work as a lovely TV show or film. I'm sure you have considered that, but is there any interest in it going that way?
They have been optioned.
Right.
Optioned for... Now, which to explain, that's a bit of a showbiz term. What that means is when someone options something, they give you a little bit of money to think about making it into a TV programme, and then it doesn't happen. But it's nice. But I assume at some point something that has been optioned gets made into TV, but not in my experience. You just get a little option and they just think about it.
And it's nice that it's a central character who's a female character. Was that a deliberate decision? Because obviously you're basing on your well, self. It's
there was a slightly weird thing talking to the people about the book. More than one person has sort of described Bonnie as a neurodivergent protagonist.
Okay.
And I was like, no, she's based on me. So you've embarrassed yourself there. What are you talking about? Yeah, she has to put on a disguise in order to be her true self. What? I've forgotten what the question was.
Well, it's nice that that is interesting because she's a girl, but she's playing a presumably a male detective.
Yeah.
So it is. You know,
let's not think too hard about that.
But it's interesting. But I think it's nice as well because it's often, you know, it feels like it feels like it's a book for boys or girls, right?
So, I think so. Well, when I was a kid. I was never a particularly roofty-tufty, sporty boy. No way. I don't know who said that, but thank you. But still, I remember not reading, like, Sophie's World, a book which I read later and thought was great because I thought it was a girl's book. I remember not reading Philip Pullman's Northern Lights books because someone had bought them for my sister and I thought they were girls' books and I thought you weren't allowed to read them. And I was so annoyed at myself. And so I wanted to try and... Because broadly speaking... Boys don't read books with female protagonists.
Yeah.
I think that's a generalization, but I think there's some truth to it. And so I wanted to do a female main character, but I wanted it to be one that I would have read as a kid to sort of trick me into reading it.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
I do, yeah. But it's interesting. And I understand, I heard somewhere that you're on tour.
I am on tour.
Yeah, I don't know where.
Word
I
has
that.
Got around, I'm glad.
What's the is this is a new this is
this is a
new show?
It's a new show. Well, in fact, it's a show I did at the Fringe a couple of years ago.
Oh, okay.
But basically, I've got spare shows from before I did anything good on the internet. So
I
used one of those on my last tour.
Yeah.
And I've got a show called Nevermore, which I haven't toured before. So if you didn't see it at the Fringe, you haven't seen it. It's different, and it's all about how I hate the sea. It's a lot of comedians are afraid to speak out these days and really talk about what a bastard the sea is, but not me, the only comedian not afraid to really stick it to the sea. It's not about that. there is a very faint nautical theme, but it is mostly jokes.
And are you finding, you know, off the back of this internet success that you're talking about, are you moving up in venues and is the audience there?
It's a very weird experience because I had a good Fringe in 2022 last year.
Yeah, that would be 2022.
Or 2 years ago if you're listening to this as a podcast.
Maybe 4 years ago if we really hold this back.
Up to 4 years ago if some more properly famous people appear and jump the queue. What's the question?
I
had a good Edinburgh Fringe,
and it
sold out, and they bought on extra shows, which never happened to me before, and it was lovely, and people were coming because they'd seen me online, and people who hadn't seen me before were coming, which was really, really nice. But at the same time, at the Edinburgh Fringe, everyone is so tired, and they've all seen three shows.
Yeah.
And doing it on tour, so it has been a very different experience because, well, not every show has been, you know, amazing. I do make an effort, but it's really nice to have an audience that have come out to see you. Yeah. And this might be the only thing they're seeing that week or the only thing they're seeing that month.
Definitely.
And so it has an energy to it, which is, I mean, this night is a bad example of that. But other times there's a vibe from the audience are giving something.
An absence of energy is still an
it is a form of energy. but you begin to realise when you hear really experienced comedians talk, they often talk about trying to sort of tickle the audience or get laughter out of the audience, the idea that the audience brings the laughter and it's the comedian's job to release it. And it feels like just a big... just because I always thought of it as like, no, I'm bringing my sort of sack of jokes and just hoping that each one goes over well. Yeah. And just starting to sort of look at it in a different way as if, oh, there's this, all this potential for enjoyment, how to release that in an amusing way. Haven't really worked it out. But it's something to think about, isn't it?
It is something to think about. But I think, you know, it's so... I think this is... it's, you know, your stuff online is terrific and, you know, I've been a fan of yours for a few years. I saw you do a new Act of the Year competition that I compared and I remember you from that.
Two of them, actually.
Yeah.
Don't remember it that well.
That might be why I remember you, just because he come back.
Yeah.
He can't be the new Act of the Year again. That's not... he can't be the new Act it was, 2 years.
It was quite undignified. I came joint third.
Yeah.
Which is slightly worse than not turning up. Joint third with Amy Gledhill Amy Gledhill and the Delightful Sausage fame. She's doing all right. So, you know, it's fine to be joint third. But then the next year, none of the people who had ranked above me could come back to do the returning champion spot because they'd all moved on. And so they had me, the person who barely placed, come back and do that. And here he is, having achieved nothing in the intervening 12 months. And it was nice.
But anyway, and he's also left the Leicester Mercury Comedian of the Year, 2017, but, you know, it still counts. But it's still... so you've had a lot of success. But it's great to see the... it's great to see...
that was Chortle Breakthrough Act in 2020.
That's the 2020s.
Recent. Thank you to the three people who woo everything I say. But it's starting to sound like pity at this point.
What I was trying to make a nice point was just to see, you know, the work you did online has paid off and, you know, led to this book and led to the tours, you know, being
able
to do
this. Have I been too negative? Have I?
No, not at all, but I just...
because my comedy is quite upbeat and positive, but as a person, I'm very...
You're negative about yourself. I don't care, that's fine, you're allowed to be. It saves me doing it. And so it's... but I think
it's quite good. Please come to the tour and buy the books, as they are honestly okay.
They are very good. But for other comedians...
my dad's read half of it.
But other comedians, I think it's good to see that that's a viable way through, right? So I think, you know, and I think you were... the Mock the Week and everything is led to you destroying Mock the Week. But it's... you know, it's led on to things. So, you know, it's a great example. And, you know, the work you put is way too much. But it does make it all very funny. Look, we're going to have to end it there. But ladies and gentlemen, please give it up. The amazing Alistair Beckett-King! Hang around. Come back next week. We'll see you next week. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Alistair Beckett-King. Thank you to Scant Regard, who provide the music. I'm indebted to George the Incompetent Soundman and Beck Cliff and everyone at the Norwich Playhouse. Thank you so much for having us. And thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, of course. And we mustn't forget him or Ben Evans. This is a Sky Potato Fuss and GoFasterStripe.com production.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. it'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.